What is love? We know when we have it, but do we actually understand it? It might be all we need, according to the Beatles, but where does it come from? What's happening at a biological level that makes us do stupid things? Why does love exist? What builds it? What breaks it? How do we get more of it? This season, we are examining relationships with the goal of building better relationships with others and with ourselves. It will be positively bursting at the seams with mindset lessons from the psychology of attachment, emotions, maturity, and trauma, whilst also covering things like self-sabotage and victim mentality to communication theory and just becoming more interesting as a person. It's going to be a truly awesome array of wisdom lined up, but first, I thought we should start with developing a ground-level understanding of the chemistry and biology and psychology of love. You'll find that it's a topic just as fascinating as the other delicacies lined up I've mentioned, and I think covering this now will also provide the foundation for us to build upon so that we can comprehend at a much deeper level all the complex and varied topics in the psychology of relationships at large. Love itself is actually made of three main areas: lust, which is the sexual interest in someone; attraction, which is liking and desire for someone or something; and finally, attachment, that is friendship and honest intimacy and bonding. These elements individually have very distinct and different chemical and hormonal responses associated with them. And by diving in to understand our biological systems for love, we can shed light on subjects like styles of attachment, confidence, the intriguing loss of rationality observed by many in love, and other unhelpful responses like my previously unexplainable complete loss of ability to say anything sensible, funny, or representative of my usually buoyant and curious personality when confronted by the opposite sex. We will dig in after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
I haven't discussed love and relationships heavily on the podcast in the 7 years that we've been running, and it's about time that we do it properly. There is so much bad advice out there that is the opposite of growth mindset. There's a content obsession with the problems of others, like identifying narcissism in your partner, why you deserve better, and then of course concluding that any mistakes that you make aren't your fault because of trauma, etc. And I'm not saying that these items have no validity at all, but I do believe on focusing our examinations into what we can improve in ourselves through ownership, whilst also empathizing with the inabilities that we might observe in others compassionately. Because ultimately, 99% of people aren't calculatingly evil or deliberately toxic, they're just uninformed and inept. Now, launching into the science-backed mindset shifts that we can make to improve our relationship with ourselves and, of course, with others. We should start with the biological constituents of love. We have lust, attraction, and attachment, all with their own hormones and neural pathways. Starting with the spicy topic of lust, lust is the kick in the loins driving us to desire sexual gratification. As with all forms of life, we have a hardwired biological need to reproduce. You are the direct descendant of tens of thousands of beings that managed to survive long enough to find a mate to have babies with, and those babies grew up and survived long enough to find a mate to have babies with, and so on and so forth, until eventually, and quite incredibly, you arrived here today. Your body is a structure of 40 trillion cells, all with precious DNA that wants you to replicate. So it's no surprise that sex feels rather pleasant and that we aren't satisfied with just doing it once and then forgetting about it for a few years. Our entire species depends on us being randy. And where does that randiness come from? Nestled in the brain is our hypothalamus, which plays a crucial role in controlling the sex hormones testosterone and estrogen. These hormones are often stereotyped as male and female, but they both play a role in both sexes. Testosterone can increase the libido of anyone, and estrogen has also been shown to increase sexual motivation and is also involved in a functioning male erection. Where do they come from? Well, mainly produced in the testicles and ovaries, but also in the adrenal glands and fat tissues. Now, it's not just recently that we've become a bit obsessed with the human sex hormones. In fact, in ancient China, 2,000 years ago, any counselors to the emperor were castrated to become eunuchs so they could have a more balanced and temperate view and not harbor any hidden motivations for legacy, which seems a bit unfair, but it does make an interesting point about how it drives our personalities. The sex hormones remind us that what matters to us is creating more of us, which in turn has a big impact on our priorities and personality. Pet owners will notice the difference in their pets before and after castration, which typically makes your pet less fiery, less territorial, and much easier to get on with. In humans, it honestly does the same thing. Sex hormones can switch off our rational side of the brain and drive us to be more easily upset, anxious, or angry. And on this topic, I would think twice before taking hormonal contraception, as it genuinely does mess with the body's natural systems for emotional regulation, flooding your receptors with more hormones than they were designed for, and there is quite a lot of evidence that it can trigger people who take hormones to become more anxious and dysregulated. And I'd be especially careful taking the pill if you're still maturing in your teen years, because this is also whilst the brain is developing, and that means any behaviors that you learn during those periods can impact your long-term behavior patterns. Now, if this is too late for you to change that and you took them during your teens and that's gone past, don't panic, it's not a life sentence. This is the growth mindset, after all, where we do learn to control our destiny. However, it is something to be mindful of. Moving on to the emotion of attraction. What is going on that makes us feel like we can fall in love at first sight or become surprisingly tongue-tied and uncoordinated by the simple presence of someone else? Well, the answers lie in biology. Attraction, of course, has similarities to lust. Both of them involve desire, but they are quite distinct and don't necessarily imply the presence of the other. Now, because of this, attraction has very different neural pathways and hormones. It mainly uses our reward mechanisms. In fact, if you simply look at a photo of someone you are attracted to, your neural reward pathways will light up like crazy, which is partly the reason why adverts are full of hot people. The two hormones related to attraction are dopamine and norepinephrine, which is otherwise known as adrenaline. They can both make us giddy, energetic, and positively euphoric. They can also decrease appetite and cause insomnia. When Aerosmith sang, "I don't want to close my eyes, I don't want to fall asleep, because I'll miss you, babe," they probably just had too much adrenaline and dopamine going on and needed to calm down a little bit. Dopamine, you've probably heard of by now, is the reward molecule, which we experience when we do a positive behavior, and dopamine serves to make us feel good and do more of that behavior. In this case, for romance, that means dopamine will trigger you to spend more time with the loved one, and aspirationally perhaps do things like having sex, although it's not so much of the lust drive. Looking at adrenaline, this is wired into our fight and flight response. It keeps us on high alert during stressful situations that are important to our survival. It also turns out that adrenaline is just as interested in the survival and replication of our genes, which makes a lot of sense. Well now, what about that dry mouth sensation and completely empty brain that you might be familiar with when startled by an attractive other person? It turns out that besides the fight and flight response, adrenaline also causes a freeze response sometimes. So it's just some good old pure terror that you're experiencing thanks to adrenaline. A further interesting point about attraction is that it reduces serotonin, which is involved in appetite and mood, which is one of the reasons that love can make us a bit more unhinged, let's say. It's been found that individuals with obsessive compulsive disorder suffer from lower serotonin. And so the fact that attraction also lowers serotonin can explain some of the reasons why we might become more obsessive or infatuated during the early stages of love. And hold that thought for later. Lastly, we have the area of attachment, which is essential for long-term relationships. When we're able to depend on our partners for friendship and companionship, it's proven to make us live longer and happier. Where lust and attraction are more romantically focused, attachment is different. It's a more universal love that can appear in our friendships, family, even work, as well as, of course, relationships. Now, attachment, again, we find is driven by two main hormones, oxytocin and vasopressin. Oxytocin is referred to as the cuddle hormone, as it draws us to care for others. Intriguingly, the most intense activities someone can go through to create oxytocin are sex, breastfeeding, and childbirth. They are very different activities to experience in the moment, but all very important precursors to bonding. And I think it serves as a reminder that sex isn't just for replicating yourself, but for building stronger bonds with your partner. And also the fact that breastfeeding and childbirth are two of the main releases of oxytocin, it highlights why the mother and child dynamic is so strong, because there's just so much oxytocin-creating behavior involved. Looking at vasopressin, we find that it's more widely known for being the antidiuretic hormone that stops you from peeing at night and maintaining water retention and blood pressure. I find it crazy that it has a dual role in also bonding behaviors, not just in humans, but all mammals. If you inject a male vole with vasopressin, besides peeing less, it will be more protective of its female partner and actively push other females and males away. It's also shown to make males more territorial and aggressive, but it's not all bad, and it can prompt us to seek social support during stressful situations, which is quite a useful behavior. Another study has found that if you puff a jet of vasopressin up someone's nose, it makes them more likely to trust others and practice reciprocity. So if they did sell it, I might try using it in meetings or something, but future business ideas, not relevant. Anyway, it blows my mind how we can have radically different behaviors regulated by the same molecule. And it's just insane how much of our body behavior and personality is essentially driven by chemicals. This does also remind us how important it is to have three very different emotions and hormonal systems to control the three elements of love. We are, of course, attached with our family and friends and love them. But it's great that the romantic emotions aren't involved, because that would get weird. With that initial overview of hormones and emotions over, we've covered the positive sounding feelings behind our emotions, but of course there is a flip side, and that is that love hurts. Hormones that make us feel incredible and immerse us with their rewarding juices for being close to our partners, they are also able to do the opposite and leave us stranded and in despair without them. Entangled with love is also jealousy, moodiness, erratic behavior, and just total irrationality. Firstly, when we look at dopamine, you'll see that the same regions of the brain get activated when we eat chocolate or when an addict takes cocaine. Attraction controlled by dopamine is genuinely an addiction to another human being. Our brain clearly demonstrates a profound emotional dependency on our partner. In the way that an addict can go into withdrawal, we see something very similar to a love-struck individual craving the company and attention of someone they can't see. It's understandable that we can get grouchy and sad about loss. Furthermore, too much dopamine in a relationship can underlie an unhealthy emotional dependence on our partners and even lead to us being controlling of their life choices. If you're having urges to check their text or control their friendships, that's genuinely a form of abuse. Where it may be obvious that locking someone in a cupboard is too far. You've gone wrong there. But we can slip into controlling a partner's life in these more subtle ways through a little too much dopamine. There's a similar danger with oxytocin, the hug hormone. A healthy level makes us feel warm and fuzzy towards our companions, and it's great. When you look at drugs like MDMA, that ecstasy, or GHB, they cause a high release of oxytocin. This explains why we can feel such a universal love for everyone when we take those drugs, and being able to dissociate from ourselves to connect with others can be incredible, but it can also cause us to act very wildly or recklessly and do stupid, dangerous things in the name of love, perhaps getting into a fight to show someone we love them, even when they're fine without us getting into a fight. I'm sure we probably know someone who stayed in an unhealthy relationship too long or even did so ourselves. This is due to the strong bond and attachment formed from oxytocin. It can make it very hard for individuals to leave even abusive relationships when they have this overwhelming desire to maintain the connection. It's incredibly powerful. The plus side is that it can drive us to do heroic things like run into a burning building to save someone, but it's these strong urges that can also be very destructive. So again, it's fascinating to see how double-edged the swords of these hormones can be and just how complex the whole thing is. Finally, we also have the emotion of embarrassment. This can be due to rejection and feeling unworthy when our love is denied. When you have strong feelings, it's often a really bad thing, and thus we can feel a lot of shame about it. But that's not the only area of embarrassment. Embarrassment can also be entirely self-inflicted from our behaviors. Lust and attraction turn off the regions of the prefrontal cortex needed in critical thinking, essentially turning us into a bit of an idiot who does dumb things that we'll later regret. I'm sure most of us have had a relationship that we regretted, despite the fact that all the red flags were there from the start, up front, but we ignored them and rushed in because we simply lost our ability to think rationally. Hopefully you haven't become so irrational that you've gotten a declaration of love tattooed on you forever in a moment of passion, but I think most of us have maybe spent some money we shouldn't have spent or been a bit ignorant of our friends whilst mesmerized by love. As mentioned earlier, it's the loss of rationality that can drive us to do things like stalking and obsessing that we'd never normally do when behaving rationally. People have described themselves as feeling possessed, and I think that's a very accurate way of putting it because it's a huge amount of hormones and emotions that aren't normally there in your body, which are completely changing your personality and your priorities. Of course, it still doesn't mean that stalking or obsessing is a good thing, but it is interesting to dive into the biology of it. A study on rationality and love that I found fascinating, done across a few universities, examined relationships by asking those who were in a relationship to score how likely they thought it would be to succeed, and they then compared this to their friends who also gave a rating of how long the relationship would last. And it was very clear that in the early days of love, we are incredibly optimistic about how long this love will last compared to our friends who are observing from a step away and thinking a lot more rationally about how the relationship will go. And it's very hard to remember this when we're feeling overwhelmed by love. But actually, if it's early days in a relationship, there's probably a lot to find out that means that we don't need to be quite so head over heels or certainly obsessive or stalkery about it. And hopefully this could help us calm down a little bit. So now we've completed a very quick overview of the main emotions in love and the hormonal drivers behind them. There's certainly a lot more in the neural pathways and creation of behaviors that I'd like to talk about, but this is a really important start for us to work on. It's commonly said that choosing the right partner is one of the most important decisions of your life. A healthy relationship can provide the security and encouragement to be our best selves whilst also increasing our actual lifespan and our happiness. Whereas a toxic relationship can drain our energy, can drain our finances, and leave us depressed and traumatized. Love can be both the best and worst thing for you, from getting up in the morning singing with joy to never wanting to wake up again. As we've seen with the hormones driven by love, which in turn go on to drive love, they can have a double-edged sword. Hopefully, understanding some of the science behind the fundamental nature of our emotions can help you be a little bit more rational for yourself already. More importantly, I've started with this to help us really understand the deeper sides of our potential problems when we dig into them and how to go about creating real practical solutions. This is only the start of the season, which is why there are still so many questions left to unpack. Love is, of course, not just chemicals, which can't ever quite explain all the personal and subjective experiences that we have. Besides that, there's the evolutionary drivers behind everything in our nature, which has shaped our attachment, cooperation, and pair bonding patterns for thousands of years. Attachment styles is a really complex area that is one of the more misunderstood fields that shape so much of our behaviors and also our negative patterns. And besides, of course, knowledge and awareness, one of the biggest improvements that we can make are in communication, to understand each other better and better explain our needs and wants without it coming across badly. A great addition to this is, of course, personal confidence, which allows us to be more connected and accepting of our own value and needs. And then for any of the geeks amongst us, we might also dive into some of the neurogenesis patterns in the brain, things like mirror neuron systems and unpacking our stress responses. In the next episode, we'll be diving deeper into friendship, companionship, and the secrets behind successful relationships. I hope to see you there. If you enjoyed the insights, feel free to share with a friend or hit me up with a comment on Spotify, Apple, or YouTube. If you have any questions for the series of things that you're particularly interested in this area, I'd love to see them in the comments or email me at growthmindsetpodcast@gmail.com. Until then, remember that life is short and to be enjoyed. So don't wait for the life you want to start living after you've dealt with a bunch of other things first. Get busy living that life right now. So be kind to yourself, and whilst you're at it, be kind to someone else too.